The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
Welcome to Capital Thinking. We have a great show for you lined up here. We're going to talk about lots of different things happening on Capitol Hill this month of February, a very active time in D.C. But we're going to start by concluding some of our look back at the State of the Union address by President Obama, some of the key issues he is dealing with. We spent a little time on higher education last week. We're going to spend some more time on that this week. Joining us, Amy Budner-Smith and Dana Weeks from Patton Boggs, where they focus a lot of their time on higher education issues. Ladies, welcome back to the show. And Amy, let me start with you. We did talk State of the Union for a whole hour last week. We did a little bit with Jeff Livingston from McGraw-Hill Education about higher ed issues mentioned by the president, but why don't you recap for us what some of the key issues the president talked about in the State of the Union were and where you think they're headed?
Sure, Kevin. Thanks. I'm happy to be back. As you know, education was actually a pretty large focus of the speech since it's so closely tied to the president's theme of income inequality. And while he certainly spoke of some priorities in early childhood and K-12 education, like connecting schools and libraries to high-speed internet and support for expanding high-quality preschool programs, there were several tidbits in there for the higher education community as well. So I'll run through just a few of those, the first being the college rating system. And while he didn't specifically discuss the college rating system in his speech, this is the system he proposed last August. He did allude to shaking things up in higher ed to get more information out there to parents and students. And this is essentially what he meant, what he was referring to. Specific mention of the rating system did appear in the White House fact sheet that was circulated after the speech, and that noted that the president will continue to pursue action on this. So we'll talk more about the rating system in a minute, but first let me touch on just a few other issues in the speech. The next being, you know, his focus on improving college opportunity and graduation for low-income students. We'll certainly continue to see the administration work with higher education leaders on these issues, we believe. The next is around job training. And, you know, Vice President Biden is expected to be a key player in reviewing the federal job training system. The White House actually already announced $150 million last week for ready-to-work grants targeted at the long-term unemployed. We expect the actual solicitation to be out any day now, but those grants will likely go to cities, community colleges, businesses, you know, and others that partner to help match the unemployed to jobs and provide them with the skills training they need for those jobs. So the last area is around manufacturing. Something that many research universities have been following is the administration's investment in manufacturing innovation. And despite Congress not having passed legislation to authorize a network of manufacturing institutes that the president actually called for last year, the president committed in his speech to doubling the number of current institutes this year. So that's adding four more this year. So we'll see a lot more funding being directed there, both from federal government and private industry. But we know departments of defense and energy will likely take the lead here again on those institutes.
Very good. Well, Daniel, let me shift to you. I know that the Department of Education has started to take comments about this proposed college rating system. I understand there's a great deal of concern and maybe some skepticism inside the higher ed system about how this will play out. So talk to us about what the department is doing and how they're moving forward with this idea.
Thanks, Kevin. So the department is, in fact, moving forward with establishing a college rating system, even as many institutions have credible concerns about it. Earlier this week, we saw the Department of Veterans Affairs launch the GI Bill comparison tool on its website. That tool is supposed to help veterans calculate how far their post-9/11 GI Bill benefits will go towards paying for college by providing information such as graduation rates, default rates, and average student loan rates for a college or a university. The site is also supposed to help veterans estimate how much of their college expenses will be covered by post-9/11 GI benefits. So given the launch of the VA's comparison tool, which in and of itself is a step closer to a rating system, I would say to those stakeholders who are strongly opposed to a college rating system and are in fact holding out for the department to change its mind about this, given the concerns and feedback expressed by institutions of higher education, that they're really fighting a losing battle here. So many colleges and universities are actually concerned about the unintended consequences from a federal rating system, such as creating incentives for schools not to accept high-risk students. They're also concerned about whether a system can have metrics that really do capture the intangible qualities and value of a school, and if data is actually available for certain metrics, and if so, how should it be properly reported? I also think many of the concerns are centered on what metrics should be used to hold an institution accountable, especially if Title IV funding is tied to the system. So this is all to say that there is a laundry list of concerns, and colleges and universities are very, very wary, and their concerns seem to be valid. As for next steps, Kevin, there are two dates I'd like to keep in mind or have people keep in mind. The first date is actually today. The department's National Center for Education Statistics solicited feedback about the college rating system from experts at a technical symposium this morning. And the second date is February 20th, when NCES will hold another symposium of about 20 experts from institutions of higher education and organizations to also share their recommendations on all the areas that the department included in its request for information. Those include data elements, metrics, methods of data collection, weighting and scoring, and presentation of the rating system. NCES will then post all of these recommendations on the college affordability portion of the department's website, and we'll then likely see a proposal from the department in May or June of this year, although it could be earlier, probably this spring.
Interesting. Well, Amy, let me come back to you and say, Congress obviously isn't going to just sit by and watch the president create this college rating system. What do you expect that they will do as they are in the process of gearing up for a reauthorization of the Higher Education Act over the next couple of years?
That's a good question, Kevin. No surprise here, but the reception of a rating system on Capitol Hill has received mixed reviews. Generally, I'd say there is skepticism among many education leaders in Congress about tying the rating system to financial aid in particular, though we have already seen bills introduced to that effect late last year. Overall, you know, there is support to continue transparency of information and hold institutions accountable to how they use federal financial aid dollars. I doubt we'll find consensus from them to include any sort of funding mechanism tied to the rating system in draft higher ed bills that we see come out this year. And I'll just kind of walk through that process of really where each chamber is in drafting the legislation and what we expect to see for a higher ed reauthorization bill. So both education committees in each chamber have held and continue to hold hearings related to reauthorization. The House is a little further along than the Senate. The Senate's only about halfway finished with its hearings. Committee staffers in the House are still reviewing comments that stakeholders submitted last August on reauthorization. So they're a little behind, but we expect a bill to be introduced by April, I would say, of this year at the earliest, probably pushing into summer. But, you know, we are hearing that the leaders are committed to passing something before August recess in that chamber. So we'll see. As I mentioned, the Senate's a little further behind, and Health Committee Chairman Harkin has admitted he likely won't get a bill to the floor this year. He's noted some of his other priorities, which center around a universal pre-K measure and raising the minimum wage before he retires at the end of the year. However, that doesn't mean the higher ed community, you know, shouldn't be on the Hill talking to them about a bill, because, you know, the Senate staff will work on one, and we're optimistic something will be introduced this year, which, you know, as you know, sets precedent for future endeavors in the next Congress.
So, Dana, we've talked a lot about the legislative side. What do you think is happening on the regulatory side for higher ed?
We're most likely going to see the Department of Education issue a proposed rule on gainful employment. As Amy and I wrote about in the Capital Thinking blog last year, this past fall, a negotiated rulemaking committee met to prepare a proposed rule on measures that determine whether certain post-secondary educational programs actually lead to gainful employment and the conditions under which these educational programs should remain eligible for federal student aid. Although the committee had difficulty reaching an agreement, we do expect the department to move forward with issuing a proposed rule and opening a comment period during the first half of this year. We'll also hear more discussion about the department on issues related to cash management, state authorization, and distance education. We'll hear about clock to credit hour conversions, adverse credit, and repeat coursework, as the Department of Education just completed selecting members of its negotiated rulemaking committee on program integrity and improvement. The first meeting for that negotiating rulemaking committee is supposed to take place later this month on February 19th. Also, Kevin, with the Carl D. Perkins Career and Technical Education Act of 2006 expiring last year, we think that both the White House and the Department of Education will speak more about career and technical education and further promote the President's blueprint on CTE released in 2012. With such a strong focus on the relationship between workforce development and education in the President's State of the Union that Amy talked about, we think the administration will be integrating CTE into these conversations, especially when it comes to aligning CTE programs with labor market needs and public-private collaborations, especially with the next White House summit most likely focusing on public-private partnerships in education. We'll also see the President and the Department call for Congress to act on reauthorizing the bill.
And I'll just add one thing to what Dana mentioned, which is, you know, around experimental sites. So late last year, the department asked for ideas from institutions to test alternative ways of increasing education quality while also reducing costs and still allowing those schools to be eligible for Title IV student aid. This, of course, is tied to the President's College Affordability Plan, but, you know, seeks to allow some flexibility for cost innovations. Responses were due at the end of January, and based on that feedback, we expect the department to publish a second Federal Register notice and announce those approved experiments and then invite institutions to apply for them. And I'll just again reiterate, Dana talked a lot about the college rating system, but you know, we know the department and White House, those education policy staffers over there are actually working as we speak to create that college rating system. So, we do expect to see a proposal, you know, later this spring so that it can be functional for the 2015-2016 school year, which is what the President has laid out.
Very good. Well, ladies, hit everybody up with your contact information. Amy first.
You bet. You can get me at abudnersmith, that's A-B-U-D-N-E-R-S-M-I-T-H, at patentbogs.com.
And you can reach me, Dana Weeks, D-W-E-E-K-E-S, at patentbogs.com.
Very good. Well, we're going to take a commercial break. When we come back, we will talk about a lot that's happening with tax reform and some changes in the Senate Finance Committee right here on Capital Thinking.
Have you friended us on Facebook yet? Why not? Just go to facebook.com/World Talk Radio or search for the keywords World Talk Radio. Once you're a part of our Facebook network, you'll receive daily messages about what's happening with our shows, this week's featured guests, and new happenings at the World Talk Radio Network. And you can add your voice to the always active discussions on our timeline. Just go to facebook.com/World Talk Radio or search for World Talk Radio.
Stay up to date on the latest news out of Washington affecting your business. Check out Patton Boggs' new Capital Thinking blog at capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com. Let one of the world's best legal and political intelligence networks keep you in the loop on the policy developments that matter to you most. Access the network today at capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com. That's capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad.
Patton Boggs principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back. We are going to talk about tax reform and what's happening with some issues in the Senate Finance Committee. Joining us is Aaron McGrain, a star associate in the Tax and Financial Services Public Policy Group here at Patton Boggs in Washington. Aaron, welcome to the show. And I think the big news this week is the potential departure of Senator Max Baucus from the chamber and most notably from his chairmanship of the Senate Finance Committee. Talk to us a little bit about the status there.
Sure, Kevin. Well, as you probably know, earlier this week, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee favorably reported on Baucus's nomination, and later today, we expect the Senate to hold a floor vote on that nomination, and it's largely expected that Baucus will be confirmed. So with the assumed departure of Baucus with today's vote, we will see some shakeup on the committee. Ron Wyden is largely expected to assume the role as the committee as new chair. And then there's been speculation about the empty seat that would be filled. I think much of that points toward Mark Warner, although I've heard other names floated as well, including Amy Klobuchar. So we'll wait to see who ultimately ends up with that seat, but Wyden is largely expected to be the chair following Baucus's departure.
I'm sure Senator Warner, given the fact he's from a purple state and now faces a credible challenger where one didn't exist a month ago, is making a pretty compelling argument for why he should be next in line for that seat. So you mentioned Ron Wyden from Oregon, expected to take over as chairman for Senator Baucus. Tell us a little bit about the philosophical differences in approach between Senator Baucus and Senator Wyden when it comes to big picture tax reform.
Well, I mean, as you probably know, Wyden has historically introduced bipartisan tax reform bills in recent weeks, months, ever since Baucus's nomination. Wyden has been pretty quiet about any agenda that we might see from him in terms of getting us specifics. I think outside the scope of broader reform, when Wyden assumes the chairmanship, he'll have some initial measures to focus on, including SGR doc fix, et cetera. But once those matters are addressed, I do expect we'll see him turn quickly back to the business of reform. I don't know that we expect him to follow lockstep some of the prior proposals that he's put out. Obviously, a lot has been done within the committee under Baucus's leadership, and Wyden may want to build on that. I think before announcing, though, any official broader reform agenda, he does seem interested in pursuing tax extenders quickly. Unclear
at this point whether he would insist on doing a committee markup, which is what has been the stated preference of Ranking Member Orrin Hatch. But in any case, I think we expect they'll have more to say once he officially assumes the chair, and the tax world is all ears.
Well, let's talk about the tax world. So obviously a lot of people have spent the last few years invested in a scheme where Max Baucus headed the Finance Committee, Dave Camp headed the counterpart Ways and Means Committee in the House, and they were focused on adapting their policy initiatives to the philosophies of those two guys. When you have a change in the Senate with Wyden, and then Dave Camp at the end of this year's term limited out, and looks like he's going to be replaced by either Paul Ryan of Wisconsin or Kevin Brady of Texas,
sure,
if Republicans hold that chamber, what are you doing to advise clients? Do they start fresh, or do they go back in with those ideas and try and adapt to these new philosophies and perspectives?
I think clients are going to have to do a mix of both. Certainly, there has been a lot of work undertaken over the course of the last several years, and I don't think that those proposals, that work, I don't think all of that just goes on the flight to Beijing with Baucus. Despite the fact that we have very little tangible legislation to show for the efforts of the committees over the last couple of years, they have made considerable strides in laying the groundwork for reform. For example, you've got the chairman, Camp Baucus Roadshow, various tax working groups that they formulated, the release of several tax reform option papers and specific working drafts. All of those things, drafts though they are, will offer our building blocks for reform, and I think our clients need to continue to pay attention to them. I don't think that work that's been done already is going to go to waste. Now, certainly, Wyden is still going to want to put his own spin on reform, and so yes, clients are going to need to pay attention to. It would be worth dusting off Wyden Gregg and Wyden Coates and taking a look at those proposals and seeing what they have to, what's in those. But I don't think we are going to see an entirely fresh start or a new slate once Wyden assumes chair.
Well, let's talk about the House for a minute. I mentioned Dave Camp's term limited. I don't know if you think there'll be any effort to extend his chairmanship at the end of this year, but I also know that at the House Republican retreat last week, he got up and made a plea to not let this year go without addressing tax reform. Talk to us about the prospects of him being successful on moving that this year, especially with the changes in the Senate, and whether or not you think he has a chance to ask for that extension of a waiver.
Sure. So, yeah, Chairman Kim is still very serious about pursuing fundamental reform, and you're right, it was a frequent topic of conversation at the House Republican retreat. He, of course, would like to introduce a markup legislation, even in the coming months, but that's been true for a long time, and challenges still remain. I would say that, a path forward there is uncertain at best, just due to you have these consistently deep ideological differences between the parties in terms of what the fundamental goals for reform should be. Republicans want to construct the code on a revenue-neutral basis. Democrats want to use reform as an opportunity to raise revenue for other priorities, including infrastructure spending and deficit reduction. So there's never been agreement there. So while discussions will continue on broader reform, Senate Finance under Wyden is likely to first focus on moving extenders, and while Camp has said he's not interested in talking about extenders, consistently just focused on broad reform, I think probably as the year goes forward, there's going to be more pressure for him to actually take a look, him being Camp, to take a look at extenders. Recall, Kevin, that the last time extenders were done, they were done in ATRA, and the House got shut out of that process because they refused to engage early on. So, with no tax bills, even minor bills coming out of the House right now, the Senate, due to origination clause issues, doesn't even have a shell to gut for extenders, so they do have a procedural hurdle to overcome there. But on the House side, I think maybe over the course of the year, you'll see Camp change his dialogue on a willingness to focus at least on extenders, but we haven't seen that yet. And then you asked about whether
camp might seek a waiver. And so, no, I don't think so is the short answer. I think probably certainly most chairmen want a waiver, but those are almost never granted.
They don't want to give up their gavel.
And most people think that this is camp's last year as chair. So as you noted earlier, we all already see other members starting to throw their hat in the ring, perhaps most notably, as you said, Paul Ryan. But we have also heard, you know, Kevin Brady as well. So we'll see what happens there. But at the end of the day, I don't think that we are going to expect him to seek any sort of waiver.
So time for one more question.
Yep.
I'm going to ask you to read the tea leaves a little bit.
All right.
Put on your inside Washington cap. A lot of people said last week's State of the Union address was notable for the things the president didn't talk about as much as he did, because the thought being that if the president wanted Congress to take action on an item, he actually would downplay it in his State of the Union address so that Republicans didn't think they were denying him a priority that he wanted. So tax reform got very light mention in the State of the Union analysis. Is that because the president wants to push it along, or because the president has written it off?
Reading the president's tea leaves, one of my favorite things to attempt to do. So you're right, it got very light mention in the State of the Union address. He did make mention of corporate reform and called on Congress to enact comprehensive corporate tax reform legislation that raises revenue. So, you know, over the last years, we have seen many iterations of what reform would look like for the president, and frankly, I think it's hard to say what that is today. Even if we had a clear picture of what the president's reform objectives are, I think it seems really unlikely that he can possibly broker a bipartisan path forward. If history is any indicator, my magic eight ball says outlook not so good.
Oh, very good magic eight ball reference. Aaron, hit people up with your contact info if they want to learn more about tax reform going forward.
Sure. I can be reached at emcgrain@pattenboggs.com.
Great. We're going to be back in a moment. You're listening to Capital Thinking.
Find out which guests are being featured this week. Read our network press releases and read the blog posts from your favorite hosts. Go to iradioblog.com today, powered by the Voice America Talk Radio Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hola. Konnichiwa.
Bonjour.
Hello.
From Anchorage to Abu Dhabi.
Marhaba.
From Denver to Doha.
Ciao.
Patton Boggs makes business transactions the world over.
Oi.
Rely on our insights for your next deal. Patton Boggs, the international business team. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Stay up to date on the latest news out of Washington affecting your business. Check out Patton Boggs' new Capital Thinking blog at capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com. Let one of the world's best legal and political intelligence networks keep you in the loop on the policy developments that matter to you most. Access the network today at capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com. That's capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back
to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back. Well, one of the things landing on the president's desk in the next couple of days is a landmark five-year farm bill that took a long time for Congress to digest and arrive at some compromise solutions to reset agriculture policy here in the United States. And joining us to talk a little bit about what's in that deal and what it means for the future of what arrives on our tables and for hunger programs across the United States is Melanie Goggins, a public policy specialist in Patton Boggs' Washington, D.C. office, where she concentrates a great deal of her work on agriculture policy. So, Melanie, welcome to your maiden voyage here on Capital Thinking, and give us a sense of why passage of this farm bill is so significant and such a big win for both parties in Congress.
Yes, well, thank you so much for having me, Kevin. And as you said, it took a very long time for Congress to reach an agreement on this farm bill. It actually took them 2 years. They started working on this in the 112th Congress, and in that time, my entire apartment complex was built. So, but they finally reached a compromise, and now they have the policy for commodities, conservation, nutrition, rural development, even crop insurance for the next 5 years. So that's great, because now farmers have more certainty in planting their crops, and this bill also saves around $16 billion over the next 10 years, which is lower than both the Senate and House passed bills, but we'll take it.
Very good. Well, talk to us. Oftentimes we've seen a battle of real partisanship in big bills getting through Congress in the last few years. Things like Dodd-Frank and the Affordable Care Act were largely party line exercises. But here you've got a really different story to tell. So tell us a little bit about the voting patterns and what that says about the evolution of farm policy.
Right, Kevin. So the farm bill is very interesting because it's never along party lines. It's usually along geographic lines. Pardon me. So, for instance, this year you saw members from the Midwest vote as a block to protect corn growers in their districts and states. Meanwhile, you saw a lot of Northeastern Democrats, especially in the Senate, who voted against the bill because they felt that SNAP cuts were too drastic. And meanwhile, there was a large block of Republicans, about 103 in the House and 23 in the Senate, who voted against the bill for what they perceived as wasteful spending, especially with farm subsidies, but also with the SNAP program.
Very good. Well, let's talk about SNAP. That seems to be, when you hear people criticize the farm bill, they say that really it's not a farm bill. It's a SNAP bill with a couple of agricultural programs attached to it. So talk to us. There was a lot of debate about reform to the Supplemental Nutrition Access Program, or SNAP. Walk through us the details of the final deal.
Right. So SNAP, which is also known as the food stamp program, was a huge sticking point in this farm bill, as I'm sure it will be in future farm bills. And as you may remember, the House this year proposed to cut $39 billion from the SNAP program, and the Senate proposed to cut $4 billion. So that was a huge gap to bridge. And they ended up settling on around $8 billion, which we actually predicted on our Capital Thinking blog. And they found those savings by closing a certain loophole that qualifies everyone who receives home heating assistance to also receive SNAP benefits. So this $8 billion cut, the net effect of that is not that families who receive SNAP are receiving less benefits each month. Really, it's just that people living in those states with that loophole will be cut off the rolls. And this will affect about 20 states. So it's also not a nationwide change.
All right.
And then I think, sorry to interrupt you, I think just one other important thing to note is that there was a lot of discussion about implementing stricter work requirement provisions, and that was something that especially House Republicans were pushing. And what ended up happening in the bill is that the USDA is required to authorize states to participate in work requirement pilots, which is a minor win for Republicans. It's not as strict as the language they were seeking, and that's because they knew that what they wanted would not get past the president's veto.
Interesting. So the president threatened a veto on some of these things?
I don't think he said anything outright, but I think that it was clear that if there was a very strict work requirement, he would not sign the bill.
Very good. Well, let's transition from SNAP to talk a little bit about commodity programs, another big issue in the farm bill, everything from milk to various other products in dispute there. Tell us a little bit about how the final law is going to treat individual commodity programs. Are there specific winners and losers?
I wouldn't say specific winners or losers, but as you were saying earlier that a lot of people say it's a SNAP bill with farm provisions, the commodity title is really the farm part of the farm bill. So one big reform, which I think the entire agriculture community expected, is that farmers are no longer receiving direct payments. So they have a counter-cyclical price program and a revenue-based program, and their payments are still tied to their base acres, not their planted acres, but they will no longer receive direct payments. There was a loser in the sugar program for food processors. Food processors have been seeking to reform the sugar program, and it is intact now for another 5 years. So that's a battle they'll have to take up in 2018. And then finally, for the dairy program, a compromise was made basically in the final hour, and now there's a new margin insurance program for dairy farmers, and the supply management component, which limited the supply of milk, has been removed.
Very good. Well, we've talked a little bit about some things like the dairy program, which, as you said, went down to the final hour, and many folks thought that was one of the things maybe holding up consideration of the final deal. Mm-hmm. This is an interesting one, Melanie, for us, in that it's been a long time since Congress had a lot of bills like this where two chambers controlled by different parties sat down and really negotiated out something that everyone could go home with and declare victory on.
Right.
My question is the flip side. They got in that room and they negotiated. There must have been some items that they left by the wayside and said they couldn't agree on, and therefore they didn't make the final bill, even though they were in either the House or Senate version. Can you talk to us about some of those things that were compromised in the conference proved to be impossible?
Right. So, as you said, Chairwoman Sabinow and Chairman Lucas really did resolve a lot of issues, and they did a great job, but there were three major issues that are unresolved. The first is the country of origin labeling issue, or COOL. And basically, so this is a law that requires food retailers to label the country of origin for fresh foods, such as beef and fresh vegetables. And the WTO, after a challenge from Canada, ruled back in 2011 that this law is trade distorting. So a lot of people were calling for this to be reformed this year, and it didn't make it in the bill. And after the conference report came out, we learned that, in fact, Chairman Lucas didn't want to take up this issue all along. So that's the first major issue. The second one is what's called the GIPSA rule. And this rule has been on the books since 2011, and it basically protects small meat producers by preventing meat packers from giving preferential deals to large producers. And I think it's important to note that Congress has not appropriated funding for this rule since it was passed in 2011, but it was not addressed at all this year. And then I think the last big missing piece from the Farm Bill was an amendment from a congressman from Iowa, Steve King. And basically, he introduced an amendment that would prevent states from denying the sale of products produced in other states. This is an interstate commerce issue. And, of course, it's in response to a recent California law that prohibits companies from selling eggs in California if they don't meet the egg-laying hen cage standards. So this issue is actually heating up now, though, because the Attorney General of Missouri just filed a lawsuit against California over this. So this is going to be resolved much sooner than the next Farm Bill in 2018.
Very good. Well, so now this monstrosity, I think it's 700 or 800 pages, is being delivered to the president for signature. I imagine they'll have a nice signing ceremony. And then it's going to get dropped off over the Department of Agriculture, where I suspect they've got a lot of implementation and regulatory issues. So tell us a little bit about what's next maybe for the agency, and also what you think is next for the broader industry that's invested so much time the last few years in getting a farm bill over the finish line.
Right. Well, I think that the first thing that most people are concerned with is just finding a nice spot to relax after the 2 years of negotiations, except for whoever has to read that 800-page bill. But after that, in 2015, Congress needs to pass another child nutrition bill. So conversations will start this year, but I think that everyone is so fatigued that really action is not going to be start being taken until 2015. The SNAP issue, they did come to a compromise in the bill over the funding level. However, we're going to continue to see action on that. The USDA is publishing a study very soon about purchasing behavior of SNAP recipients. So we're going to see companies seize on that and argue for either restricting food choice or arguing for greater food choice for SNAP recipients. And then finally, just on the regulatory side, as you said, the USDA is going to have to start implementing this monster. And meanwhile, it's also continuing to implement the last child nutrition bill, which is the Healthy, Hungry, Free Kids Act. So we've got a lot of stuff coming down the pipe, even though the Farm Bill has finally passed.
It's a lot to digest for the industry in the next couple of years. Melanie, give folks your contact information if they want to learn more about the agricultural policy going forward.
Right. So my email address is mgoggins@pattenbogs.com. And we also have a great section on the Capital Thinking blog under Agriculture and Food that you can read every week.
Excellent. Well, appreciate that plug for the Capital Thinking blog. We're going to be back in just a minute to talk a little bit more about the financial services sector and what it's doing in the overall economic recovery. You're listening to Capital Thinking.
Your favorite Voice America Talk Radio Network shows and hosts are in your car, outdoors, and wherever you need them to be. Listen anywhere. Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattenboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, @pattenboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back. We're going to talk a little bit about the financial services sector and where things stand with the recovery. We're joined by Matt Culkin, who works in the Patton Boggs Washington, D.C. office and handles financial services policy there. And Matt is smartly not in Washington. He's in sunny Florida on his way to speak to a group down there. Matt, we talked a lot in the last show last week and again this week about the president's State of the Union address. I don't think he said much about financial regulation. If so, maybe I missed it when I was channel surfing. But tell us a little bit about what the president did say.
Thanks, Kevin. Thanks for having me on. And you're exactly right. Unlike in years past, where the president would really go out of his way to criticize some of the risks and crises caused by Wall Street, this year the president actually struck a very different tone. He did specifically talk about the need for legislation to prevent another housing crisis, and he does want to promote homeownership and prevent foreclosures, but what we didn't hear this year was that attack on the fat cats on Wall Street, which is a remarkably different tone than in previous years. So I think you see him pivoting a little bit towards the midterm elections and trying to really focus on the things that will make a difference for regular Americans and voters.
Well, I think maybe he's hoping for a kinder, gentler world for fat cats after all. Maybe that's why I didn't mention them. Now, on the issue of housing reform, very interesting time. We've got former Congressman Mel Watt recently confirmed to oversee government operations in that area. But what we haven't seen is sort of the landmark restructuring of the Fannie Mae's and Freddie Mac's that people thought might happen the last couple of years. Why is that? Where do you think will we see anything in that vein in 2014, given that it's an election year and the housing market is still in a sort of sensitive state?
Sure. So you're right to point out that when Dodd-Frank was passed in 2010, the omnibus financial regulatory reform bill, housing finance reform was not a part of it. So they addressed systemically important institutions and banking, over-the-counter derivatives, and a whole bunch of other things. They did not touch directly housing reform besides, you know, addressing things like a qualified mortgage. So what's happened in the last 4 years is you've seen Congress really get into the weeds and try and figure out what should be done with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Should they be abolished? Should they be protected? And so there's been a series of different legislative proposals on the House side. Financial Services Committee Chairman Deb Hensarling has put out his bill called the PATH Act. On the Senate side, there's a bipartisan proposal put out by Mark Warner of Virginia and Bob Corker of Tennessee. And that's been sort of the baseline legislative text that the Banking Committee, chaired by Tim Johnson, they're working right now at the committee level to come up with a more complete bipartisan approach that could then be taken up as serious legislation. But as you point out, we're running out of days just purely from logistics. You know, once we hit the summer, the midterm elections are going to kick into full swing. And so we've got a couple months left to go. And even as recent as yesterday, Chairman Johnson said that, you know, the devil's been in the details and they're trying to work out very technical, very complicated points so that they have a serious substantive bill to put out as a marker with the goal that the committee could take it up and show some progress. You know, I doubt that we'll see a bill make it through both the House and the Senate before the end of this congressional term, but if serious progress can be made on both sides of the Capitol, then when they come back after the midterm elections, you've got a good chance at the Obama administration claiming victory by putting through some sort of GSE reform before they leave office.
Interesting. Well, I know one of the more complicated things to come out of Dodd-Frank was the so-called Volcker Rule. I've read lots about this. It seems to be a Wall Street Journal a hobby horse, but I think it's little understood what it is and why it's so controversial, or even if and when it might take effect. So talk to us a little bit about where the Volcker Rule stands today and what it is.
Sure. So first and foremost, the final Volcker Rule was adopted jointly by the five major financial regulatory agencies back in December. The bill is, the actual rule text is only 71 pages, but it's preceded by an 892-page preamble with almost 3,000 footnotes. So there's a lot of information in there.
I hope you read all 3,000 footnotes.
Our team has been through it very, very carefully for a series of different clients. What the rule is designed to do is really two things. One is to limit proprietary trading by banks. So banks who use the funds that they hold and trade with that money. And two, to restrict what banks can do in terms of investing or sponsoring certain hedge funds or private equity funds. And, you know, over the nearly 900 pages, there's a series of different carve-outs, exemptions, different restrictions based on how large or how small the bank is, but the fundamental purpose is to reduce the systemic risk that banks might pose. And so as you can imagine, whether you're a community bank or a large international bank, you're going to have a different Volcker Rule experience. And then just the restrictions themselves are going to trickle down and impact investors, non-U.S. institutions, institutional investors, retail investors, up and down the sort of the food chain. When it was adopted in December, there was an immediate reaction from some of the banks that the Volcker Rule prohibited what's called the use of collateralized debt obligations backed by an instrument called a trust preferred. And so the American Bankers Association actually filed a lawsuit immediately trying to have that specific provision changed. And the five agencies came together and created an interagency working group and just last week issued an interim final rule that amends that provision so that small and local banks can continue to hold those sorts of assets on their balance sheet without violating this new regulation.
Very good. Well, I know, Matt, a lot of your practice focuses on Dodd-Frank implementation, especially in the regulation of the derivatives market. Talk to us a little bit about what the federal agencies are doing there these days.
Sure. Well, we're in a time of transition at the primary derivatives market regulator called the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. The previous chairman was a gentleman named Gary Gensler, and his term expired at the end of 2013. A nominee by the name of Tim Massett has been put forward by the president, and his nomination is pending, along with another Democrat named Sharon Bowen and a Republican named Christopher Giancarlo. And so we expect the Senate Agriculture Committee, which has jurisdiction over the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, to hold a confirmation hearing sometime probably in early March and then confirm those nominees if they make it through in the coming weeks or months. But so right now at the CFTC, you have an acting chairman named Mark Weechin and a Republican commissioner named Scott O'Malley and a third commissioner named Bart Chilton. And Commissioner Chilton has also announced his intention to leave the commission in the near future. So you've got sort of a handicapped leadership structure right now with three commissioners in the building and three nominees pending. And over the last couple of years since Dodd-Frank passed, they've really focused on the rule writing stage. So they've passed dozens and dozens of rules spanning hundreds and hundreds of pages. But with the new leadership coming in the next couple months, you're going to see the CFTC change from really a rule-writing agency to more of a compliance or enforcement agency. They need to register some new companies as things that are called swap data repositories or swap execution facilities, but they'll also begin to more vigorously enforce the rules that they've just finished writing. So that means that both the staff and the leadership there will transition and have a new focus and sort of a new mandate. The most recent sort of notable development that the CFTC completed what's called a made available to trade determination. And what that means is for the most liquid over-the-counter swaps, they now need to be registered for the first time on registered trading platforms called swap execution facilities. And the first date that some of these swaps will have to go on these platforms is February 15th. So as you can imagine, the week before, you've got market participants, platforms, and regulators all scrambling to make sure that they've got their ducks in a row and that this transition happens very smoothly.
Very good. Well, we've talked a lot about the agencies and dim prospects for reform on the Hill in a couple of areas. Are there any areas where you think the Hill will take action this year?
I think the Hill will very actively continue its role in oversight of the financial regulators. As we've seen through the Dodd-Frank implementation process, while they finished their substantive work in writing the bill nearly 4 years ago, they have maintained a constant presence with the regulators through hearings and letters and even legislative proposals to amend some of Dodd-Frank. And I think you'll see that continue through the midterm elections. And we've touched on housing reform. We've touched on the Volcker Rule. We've touched on CFTC nominees. The Commodity Exchange Act, which authorizes the CFTC, is actually up for reauthorization. So you'll see the Senate Agriculture Committee and then the full Senate take that up in the coming months. There's been a big issue about bank ownership of different areas of business related to physical commodities. There's been a lot of press about it, and so we've seen a few congressional hearings on the topic, and I think that will continue. There's a lot of talk about how to regulate virtual currencies like Bitcoin, and so I think you'll see Capitol Hill continue to research those topics and bring in interested parties and learn more. I don't know that legislation will happen, but they'll certainly continue to have a very obvious presence. And then last but not least, I think the we've seen with some of the data security questions, we'll continue to watch Capitol Hill explore those issues and see how banks are protecting customer information, and also the quality of the data that financial institutions are providing regulators. There's an office in the Treasury Department called the Office of Financial Research, and they recently published their annual report, which talks about the need for quality, cumulative, accurate data provided to regulators to identify and mitigate any future systemic risk and really try and prevent a future financial crisis.
Gotcha. Well, Matt, hit people up with your contact information.
Absolutely. My phone number is 202-457-6056. My email address is mkulkin, K-U-L-K-I-N, at Patton Boggs. And, of course, we publish a weekly update for our blog under the Financial Services tab, and we'll keep that as current as we can.
Very good. Well, that's going to do it for this week's Capital Thinking. A happy weekend, everyone. We'll be back next week with another great show.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.